Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you, man?
Good.
So we're back in your office, and we have somebody this, and you're with your cousin?
Yes.
Yeah. The same hairstyle. Only he has like hair different parts of his face, but...
Excellent. Yeah. So who are you, sir?
I'm Matt Podwarsaki, and I'm with Microsoft Consulting Services in the DC area.
Okay.
So that's why I have my COBOL shirt on today.
Absolutely.
Because you know he works with you know real customers, with the government, and so on.
Yes.
So
who are still using COBOL?
Oh, I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are.
But in fact, he is. I think Matthew is one of the kind of biggest functional programming fans that I know.
Yeah.
He has a very interesting blog where, you know, it's like, I don't know where he finds the time to write it. I don't have the time to read it.
Yeah.
I kind of, you know, every once in a while I catch up. It's great blogs.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's why it's great to have him on Channel 9.
Okay.
Yeah. It is a lot of fun to write them. It's on top of the 40 some odd hours you have to put in minimum per week, and then to blog on top of that gets a little difficult sometimes. So a lot of my writing and inspiration comes in the 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock time frame.
Wow.
I really enjoy writing about functional programming. I think that that this this rediscovery that I have of it has led me to explore some really interesting areas, but also run into where it falls down and so on, such as kind of exploring lots of different areas, concurrency and so on. And so yeah, there's a bit to explore, and I don't think I'm going to run out of material anytime soon.
So you're saying you're rediscovering functional programming.
Yeah.
So when did you lose it?
When did I lose it? Well, that's a good question. Throughout school, I had introductions to Lisp and Scheme and so on that most people who have a CS bent tend to do. And then as soon as you get into the real commercial world, everyone was then pushing Java and say Java this, Java that, which is more object-oriented and imperative as you can get. And so a lot of that time, I lost a lot of those capabilities because the language restricted me. So fast forward a little bit, and I've been always kind of on the periphery interested in Haskell, and now I've kind of had more of a bent on it now that there's a little bit more exposure to it. with the release of the Real World Haskell book, has really kind of grown the community quite a bit, and you know the IRC channel is really hopping. It's sometimes over 600 people at a time on the IRC channel for that. And so that's really been rediscovering my love for it. And then with the addition of Link and C# 3.0 and F# really starts to emphasize more of the functional programming features,
mm-hmm.
That kind of rekindled my fascination with functional programming.
Interesting.
So what is your favorite feature of Haskell? So, you know,
yeah,
like, you know,
okay, well, that's a good
question. What makes your heart beat, you know, when you think about Haskell?
Well, what really gets me is the fact that it's really pure in the fact that that all side effects are made explicit. So anything that is an IO operation and so on is encapsulated within the IO monad. So to me, it makes a lot of sense to separate code in such a way that you can always predict certain behaviors about code explicitly through the contract.
So let's kind of, you know, write some code on the board.
Okay.
I think, you know, when we're talking about, you know, these things, I think, you know, some code is very illustrative. So why don't you kind of, you know, write a little like hello world, imperative hello world in Haskell.
Okay. Imperative in Haskell.
Yeah, hello world with where the effects are visible. Just, you know.
Oh, okay. All right. So if we have our main here, so we have our main, which is Should I put actually put a signature on it?
Sure, of course.
All right, so there's no arguments, and then it goes to a
so this is a check whether he's a real Haskell programmer.
Because of the direction of the arrow?
No, it's because. Yes. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the difference between the ML guys and
yes,
the Haskell guys.
Yes, yes, I'm sorry. So we will, if we use the syntactic sugar to it, we say something like this, main equals do, and then we will go ahead and put Sterling, Sterlin, hello, world.
Yep. So this is like, you know, the Haskell version of Hello World, and a lot of people think, oh, Haskell looks weird. We can make it look even more like C sharp, right? Because we can put, you know, semicolons and curly braces. So now, you know, I don't know, but this looks very, very much like C, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's absolutely.
Haskell is a language with curly braces. So
yes.
And even you, Charles, you said, you know, maybe Haskell should have a different syntax, but
yeah.
I mean, it is, you know, this looks very much like an imperative program. It is an imperative program.
But look at that. Let's talk a little bit about the arrow pointing to the IO monad.
Yes.
That's something that's kind of implicit.
By the way, it has this type, right?
Yes. Oh, that's right. Yes.
Okay.
So I was like even.
Yeah, so it's just IO of you.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Good. So now let's introduce an arrow for Charles. So let's instead of kind of, you know, printing hello world, print here, you know, message. And then here, what we do is you would write here message. That's the way I would write it. Arrow do.
Yep.
Curly open.
Okay.
And then the type of this becomes. String, arrow, IO of unit.
Interesting.
Okay, so now you see that one of the things in Haskell is that the kind of, you know, the structure of your program and the structure of your type is like, you know, always kind of in a one-to-one relationship, because there's like, you know, the string is here, and the result of this guy is type IO of, well, this thing returns nothing. So that's the kind of beauty of Haskell, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Plus that the fact that your signature here, this is completely optional. You don't have to write this, which is why the type and the definition here are not tied together. So, you know, I can put this anywhere, and then, you know, this is inferred. You know, as Matthew said, you don't have to write it, as a compiler will tell you, and that this is the case.
So, but I mean, let's step back
just
for a second, because we've had this conversation a lot on Channel 9,
okay.
particularly with one of the last expert to experts that we did with Joe Duffy.
Okay.
On the thread, we got sort of a Haskell programmer guy.
Okay.
Sorry that I can't remember your name, man, but I'm still talking about you.
Yeah.
Who basically was saying, you know, why don't people just learn Haskell, right? Stop trying to... do things in a way that you're used to, which really can't support what is easily supported in a language like Haskell.
Sure.
Anyway, my point is, the main string goes to pointing to the IO monad. There's some concepts there that I think that you guys are brushing over for the imperative world.
Okay,
I mean,
so
let's talk a little bit about, I mean, that does not look, that looks foreign to a C# developer.
Okay, so now let's make it look more like a C# developer. So let's define this. Type func action of A equals A arrow IO of unit. Right? So I'm defining a type.
Yeah.
I'm just giving a new name.
Okay.
And now let's replace this. Now I can say here action of unit.
Yep.
Now I say type void equals init.
Yep.
Action. Oh, I can even, let's do it even easier.
Yep.
Type action equals action of unit.
Yep.
So Charles, what is now your complaint,
my
son?
Main action.
Yeah.
Okay.
this is exactly what you would write in C#.
Yeah.
Where this is like, you know, in C# when you have action. So the thing is that in C# we write func of, you know, int, comma, bool. That is kind of painful. In Haskell you would write int arrow bool. So right. it's just kind of, you know, another notation for the same type. So but you know, and instead of angle brackets in Haskell you use
arrows.
Arrows and round parentheses everywhere. Yep. So it's
For tuples and
Mm-hmm. So it's not that different. So
No, it's not. And usually when you're using something like an action, you're usually saying that I'm going to change the state of the world in some way, because you're not returning anything. So if you follow guideline principles, when you're not returning anything, you're usually changing the state of the world.
Mm. Yes, and that is, as Matthew said, is that is here kind of, you know, explicit in this type, the fact that you're changing the world. So this thing takes an A, and you know, in C# it would just return void, but here this tells you that, you know, besides, you know, returning nothing, it also changes the world. So in the type you can see that it has a side effect, and people that in the Java world are very familiar with that because there, for example, you have the throws clause, or
that's
people
right.
that use contracts, the managed contracts that just shipped on the dev labs.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
there's also exception clauses, which is very similar to this. It's like a contract. You're specifying more that you know, more knowledge about the functions that you know, and then the compiler can track it and so on.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, monads can be used for more than just I/O, but this is one of the most common things that you're going to do in Haskell in terms of anything that deals with the outside world, whether it's going to be getting the current date, interacting with the machine in some meaningful way, reading from a database, writing to a database, anything like that is also there. What's also interesting is that there are a package in Haskell called hs.net, which is a interop between Haskell and .NET, which is kind of interesting. And what's interesting is, since Haskell can't really make any determinations on the purity of the .NET libraries, it's automatically assumed it's in the I/O. Yeah, because the .NET framework, of course, is pretty much was a thin veneer over C# 1.0, which was a very imperative and object-oriented concept, and not really pure at all. So.
Okay.
Now this was like a very simple program, but you mentioned this the real world Haskell book.
Yes.
Right. So so what is kind of your favorite example in there? Because again, a lot of people believe that, you know, you cannot do anything useful with this pure language. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, and I don't think that's true, but you know, it's like, but it's good that there's now a book that kind of you know, shows people that, you know, you can do real stuff.
Oh,
with
sure.
This.
Yes, and some of the more interesting stuff deals with you can do very interesting stuff reading and writing from the database just like you would on any other thing. But where people are actually starting to see a lot of movement is in the web space. It's interesting. There's Haps. And Hapstack, which actually are doing web applications in Haskell, so there are plenty of opportunities there. Just normal parsers and such using
Parsec.
Parsec. Yeah. Well, although you don't like it, but it's.
I don't like it. I like it.
Oh, you do? Okay. Nice. Yeah, Parsec, and then in turn, F# actually has a port of that called fparsec, which works just as well. So they actually have some examples of doing like JSON parsers and so on. Mm-hmm. That's also pretty useful for parsing data. So that's also a really cool example. But they also have some kind of WinForms-y kind of apps as well that they've written in the book. So a lot of real good examples that people. It's not just guys in lab coats writing right
people
programs.
Like Eric.
It's not guys that look kind of like me or kind of like Eric. It's actually.
But let's see, you know, we're now in this in the kind of world of monads and
yes,
parsers.
Okay.
So let's kind of talk a little bit about parsers to show kind of, you know, why this notion of a monad here that we used in this example to deal with kind of side effects on the outside world, how that kind of also works for parsers and why kind of, you know, it's that's kind of beautiful. So here, you know, we said, you know, there's this. And let me just kind of put back the good old I/O type.
Yeah.
So this thing says it's I/O of unit, which says it returns nothing, but it does a side effect,
okay.
Right? You could also say that, you know, probably like in C#, you can also have main return int, which is like a status code or something.
Yeah,
you know, -1 if something went wrong.
Okay.
Now we want to do a parser, so let's kind of, you know, a parser that returns something of type A.
Yeah.
You want to
derive it? Yeah, you can continue.
All right. So now the thing is, what is a parser?
Yeah.
Right? Well, that's something that takes a string.
Yeah.
And it parses the string. So what does it do? Well, it returns an answer, right? That's what a parser tries to do. Like, you know, it takes a C# program and it generates, you know, IL.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you just make a parser of something like string to A, that's not very useful. It's not compositional, because now I cannot kind of, you know, glue together two parsers.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you really want to do is you want to say, well, this thing takes a string, returns an answer, and then there's might be, you know, some remainder of the string. So I say, okay, look at this string. I parse it, you know, until here.
Mm-hmm.
That gives me a result. And there's a rest of the string that I can parse and combine the result. Okay, so that's kind of, you know, and then we're not yet there.
Yeah.
Because maybe this parser might return multiple results. Right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't find anything, or maybe it's an ambiguous thing. So the way you do it is, you say, okay, it returns a list of pairs of the answer and then the remainder of the string.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
That's the simple parser type.
Okay.
Okay. And now we can kind of, you know, write computation. So now we can write things like, you know, recognize character, you know, which is type char, arrow, parser.
Yeah.
Of, well, unit, and then parser unit, right? Or, I don't know, maybe parser char or something like this. And so in this way, you know, you now see that again, in some sense, this was like, I want to do I/O of unit here, and parser of unit. So now what you see is that in some sense, you know, I'm saying this thing takes a character, and it kind of returns no useful result. But it has a kind of, you know, it changes the world. Just like I/O changes the world, here it has changed the world because it has taken this string and it has kind of, you know, parsed this string and gives me the rest of the string. So this kind of, you know, this thing here, plus that there's multiple results, that's kind of, you know, the same thing as, like, you know, changing the world with an I/O monad. You know, when I'm writing something to the world. So this notion of monads is a very universal idea.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's recently on my blog I was given a challenge, and they said, "Oh, there isn't any possible way that a monad would mean anything to a C# programmer." And
so he has a whole blog post about, you know, monads in C#.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I did is I said,
they're hard to write, by the way.
They're well,
compared to writing one in Haskell.
That depends.
Brian Beckman showed that with the state monad. The state monad.
Oh, the state monad. Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay.
Or the state monad could be trivial in C#.
It could be. It could well be. and it could well be. So what I did is I implemented the maybe monad and said, okay, well, it might.
Let's do it.
The maybe monad?
The maybe monad.
That's easy. It might return something. It might not.
Yes.
It might have a side effect. It might not.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, it might return us a value and it might not. So I can actually write this this in F sharp actually pretty easily.
Then cool. I will do yeah. the Haskell translation yeah. because so, I couldn't write it in F sharp.
Okay. Well, since a lot of .NET programmers will watch this, we might want to just break it down and say, okay, yep. well, what are we going to do?
Yep.
So what we need is we actually need a builder to do this. So let's get rid of this for just a second. And so they provide us some syntactic sugar. So if we create a type. Maybe builder. Okay, maybe builder. Okay. And then we provide three functions, the minimum of three. So you give it a member of.
So you're doing this to kind of enable the F sharp workflows
yes.
on these things?
Okay. Correct. Good. Correct.
Yes.
So we have a bind of, let's see, of our M. and our function, okay? And all you have to do is then you have to match upon that, and so we are going to match upon our maybe, so I'm going to match M with, okay? And then we're going to, down here, do pattern matching to say, okay, well, if we get some value here, we're going to then apply F to M. Else, we're going to. Okay, wait. That's no sum. Shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sum of. Yeah. Sorry. Sum
no,
of.
No, I think this is okay because F goes
yes.
from A to maybe.
Yeah,
F
that's
B,
right. That's
sorry.
Right. So, so this will be
none.
F of none.
No, that's wait. Just none.
Oh, that's right. Done. Yes. Thank you.
Yep.
So okay.
you see that I'm getting really this shows my age, right? I
yeah.
can write Haskell on the whiteboard, but if I do F sharp, I need I
yeah.
need Visual Studio.
Yeah,
need
IntelliSense.
I need IntelliSense.
Yeah, that's kind of
it's like
kind of I'm kind of in the,
yes,
in the
yeah,
same
yes.
boat here.
So it's like
all right,
funny,
and then
but,
we yeah when we have then we also have a we need a return, which is basically to wrap the existing maybe in a new value inside the maybe. So we'll say return. So this is an option type. So in Haskell we call the maybe type. So we have our return v equals sum of v.
So I don't know what the kind of syntax is for the maybe type, but it's I let me just kind of write
sure.
the Haskell signature here. The F sharp one is kind of very similar. So
yeah.
maybe of a equals none. Or
sum
in Haskell is just and nothing.
Yeah,
I think
just and nothing.
But
yep.
so this is exactly what you said, Charles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tell me, if I tell you, I give you maybe an A, right? Maybe
yeah.
I give you an A. Then
okay.
I can either give you nothing,
yeah.
which
okay.
Coming from Holland, that would usually be the case, right?
Sure.
Or it can be something. I can give
yeah.
you so. But so Matthew will do that. So
yeah.
if you get some a maybe for me, that will probably be
yeah.
none.
And something could be an exception.
No, that's an either. That's an either.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So then we'll also have one last one, which is our delay.
Well, let's talk about that before
okay.
I'm going to interrupt you because
okay.
that's an interesting thing here. That's because Charles, you're asking really good questions. So suppose I have a function from say int to maybe of bool, right?
Mm.
Now the question is, can this function throw an exception?
It could, because and then it would return you nothing.
Oh no! But
oh, actually, no.
So it might.
Yeah.
So really, in some
yeah.
sense, if you're, is this in Haskell, if it could, if you really want to deal with dealing with exceptions and
yes.
anything, you would kind of even have to kind of put here,
that's right.
IO of maybe bool.
That's right.
Because all the effects are kind of explicit. but, you know.
So in the case where you don't have the I/O, basically what you're saying, I mean, would it really be useful without the I/O, Monad?
Well, no.
Would it be useful at all?
I mean,
yes, it's still useful.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, there's still some unsafe functions such as head and tail and so on.
Yes, sure.
We'll always throw an exception if for an empty list, but that's neither here nor there. But,
yes.
So to finish this off, so all we need is a way to invoke a delay, and there you go. There's a builder to actually create the maybe monad.
Nice.
And then all you have to do is say, let's say maybe equals new, and just say maybe builder, and so I'm just calling maybe builder. And then what you can do, all right.
I'm sorry, and is delay, is that correct? Should that
yes.
be, you know, unit arrow F of unit, or?
Yeah. So.
Should that be this?
No, it's just F of...
Of unit?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all you need. So
F sharp.
Yeah, F sharp. So now that we've got all of this, now we can actually do something interesting with it. Mm-hmm. Say, for instance, we have some lookups. We have a dictionary or a map of... let's just say we have a map of Bob and IT. So he's in the IT department. Okay. All right. So we have one of these. So we'll just call this EMPS. Okay. So we'll have a map of this. This isn't the exact syntax, but I'm trying to get through the point, and then we'll have one of like Frank and sales. Okay. So luckily, in the built-in functions, there is a try find, I believe, in the map, so that you can actually determine whether it gives you a value or not. So what you can do is you can do these cascading lookups in such a way that you can say go through all of these and say try to find an employee's so look up where the IT department is. You can then determine where it is, and then you can determine what currency they happen to use, and then return that through the maybe monad to say, well, if we can't find them, we're going to return you nothing. If we can go all the way through this, we're going to return you the person what the currency that they're going to use.
Okay.
So if you had three lookups, so let's do a function here.
Let's first write down the type of lookup.
Okay.
I mean, that's how I like to do it. If I see the type of a function, then
you know
a lot about the function.
Okay. Yeah. So a lookup. So let's say, for instance, a lookup will take a map. Actually, it'll take first a key. So it'll be a string, of a key. Okay. And then it will. Take a map. Well, actually, this will be.
Let's keep it.
All right, all right. So this will be a map of of string. Yeah. So there, and then at the end, it will give us a option, string option, at the end of our lookup function that we're creating, otherwise known as the maybe.
Okay, so let's kind of do the because we're talking about maybe, so
yeah.
Let me put maybe here. So this is another kind of interesting thing about like F sharp, right? That the type constructors are written in postfix.
Yes.
So it's like string maybe.
Yes.
Instead of maybe string.
Yes.
So it's in C sharp we have one like that, right?
Yeah.
Like T array.
Yes.
Right. Then maybe we have more like that to T star, maybe,
Yeah.
Okay.
But so this is like a postfix. So this is the type, and then this is the kind of constructor.
Interesting.
So.
Yeah.
Makes
exactly.
sense.
And then of course I think what you were trying to do was to say, well,
Yeah.
Let's generalize this, right? This was
key.
And then this was key value, and it returns a maybe a value.
Yes. Maybe the value of type specifies.
Yes.
Understood.
And and so the nice thing about this kind of syntax here is that if you write a method in C sharp, a method signature, well, one of the things, I don't know about you, but the worst thing about programming is inventing names.
Yes.
Because you always have to come up with relevant names and this and that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I'm a bad speller, so then you will make typos. So whereas here, you have, there's no names that you have to invent. Well, you have to have the name here, but you don't have to say what is the name of the parameter. You just say it's type. And here, so it's like, you know, much less clutter.
Yes.
Whereas like in C sharp, if you define a delegate type, you still have to give the names of the parameters, but they're completely useless there.
Yes.
And whereas here, you just give the type. This is the type of the lookup function. So you don't have to give the names of the parameters.
Excellent. So, I mean, if I wanted to, I say a lot, you know, in general, in life, we most of us will, you know, we don't like to commit to things, so we'll say yes, no, maybe.
Yes.
So, instead, now we can just say bool, maybe. Right? Because bool is yes, no.
Yes, maybe. Yes,
maybe turns a yes or a no.
Yes, so bool, maybe is like three-valued logic, yes.
Okay, I'm getting this stuff. I like
it. Yes, okay, good.
All right.
So now you could actually imagine if we have not only an employees, but now we also have countries. So each one will have a department. So it'll have, you know, a depth, and then it'll have a country.
So that's a map of department and country, right?
Yeah.
Let's just write it down here.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll just have a map of department and country, and then at the end we'll have a currencies map of, and that one will be of country, and then currency. Okay. So what we have here is we'll have three different maps here. So we'll have first one with our employees and their departments, next one with our departments and our countries, and then thirdly, our country and then our currency.
Okay.
Now, if we were to do this in, say, standard imperative programming, how might we do it? I mean, so basically, you would either you would write it like this: if contains key, then you're going to nest the next one, and so you would basically go through here, and you would say, okay, if amps contains. Okay, so up here, name, then you would nest it again, then you get down here, you would get the lookup of the depth, so depth equals amps of your key, of your name, and then you would move on to your next one, if countries dot contains depth, then you're going to start to see a pattern as we're walking off the side of the screen here.
Thus, you guys created Link.
Yes.
I mean, come on.
Yes, but also, I mean, even it's even worse, right? Because this guy, this depth has type maybe. So you cannot even pass it directly to contains here because you still have to strip off the
that's right.
The maybe.
Constructor here. So
but if we were saying using a mainstream imperative programming model with
Definitely. Yeah.
That's what I was saying.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, and what I would do is I would just say try, you know.
With the out with the out parameter,
or you could use Link with like join syntax, right? Like inner join, outer join on link objects, right?
Well, but he's going to use F-sharp workflows because we just shown that this guy is a monad, right?
Yes, correct. So
let's kind of
so we get that. We get that it's hard to do.
Yes.
Really complicated and sort of strange to do in imperative.
Yeah, exactly. So what you could do is instead let our res. So our res of okay. Well, actually, let's say. Find currency, and in F sharp we will take our name, which is a string, and then we will return a maybe, or not a maybe, but a string option. Okay. So then what we can do is then start to use that maybe that we talked about and throw some syntactic sugar around it. So now when we wrap everything inside this, when I said let maybe equals new maybe builder, this enables this kind of syntax. Mm. So now we can now get say let bang, which is basically the bind operator that I had before. So let depth equals map dot lookup of name. Okay, so now we get back the department. Okay, let bang country equals map dot lookup of depth, and then we can say return bang of passing in our
but you still have to do the lookup for the currency, right?
Yeah, so amps, yep. And then this one is of countries. I forgot to put that at the end. And then, yes, and return. Then we're going to return map.lookup of our country. And that will pass in our currencies. Currencies. And what this will do is it'll first go and say, okay, now if we go back to our bind syntax, what we have here is let department equals like this. So what this actually will look like to you in IntelliSense will be of type string. But what it really is a string option. So it might have a value, it might not. And what it allows us to do is it allows us to flow through in a rather transactional script right here.
Hmm. So let's write the same thing in link. Right.
Yes.
So okay. There you would write from depth in lookup name and then employees dot from country in where was that one? Countries dot lookup. What am I looking up? The employee, the department, right?
Yeah.
And then from what is the last one? Yeah, here I have to say currency.
Yeah.
In
lookup of currencies.
Currencies. Dot lookup of what was my person, my country.
Yeah.
Select currency. Var q. Equals this, and then C# will infer, or VB will infer, that this has type maybe of currency
string,
or string.
Yeah.
So even in C# you can write, once you define the sequence operators, you can write kind of, this code, and just like here, what happens is that all this kind of checking whether, if this returns none, the whole thing returns none. So that kind of, that kind
short
of flows, short circuits it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, if we go back to our previous example of the IO monad, if you look at the types of these things, so we had here, this thing had type IO of unit, which says, well, it does some side effects and then it returns no useful
nothing.
Result. In this case, when the type is maybe of string, let's do it like this. Again, you can interpret this in the same way, right? This thing returns a string, but in the process of giving you that string, it kind of, it might return nothing, or it might return that string. So again, it's the same notion of like, a computation that's happening in order to get that string. There's more behind the covers than you see, but that's kind of all hidden away in this notation, or in this notation, or in Haskell, the monad notation. So all these things are just ways to get rid of the boilerplate code.
Yeah, yeah. It's what I would always explain to people is it's abstracting away uniform complexity And for this example, it was a bunch of if statements, so it kept on crawling off the side of the screen there.
Yeah.
That we're trying to do. Now, you could say the same thing about the list monad, which is exactly an implementation with link that we're most familiar with. So what you're doing is, if you're doing, say, I can do it.
And let's wipe the whole board clean.
Yeah, right. Wipe it.
What we can do is, once we understand how link works, and the select many. So imagine if we were to try to do in C sharp, we would say from x in, and we do an enumerable, so e dot range of 1 to 10, and then from y in e r of, let's say, 11 and 10 more, and then we will say select x plus y. So what is that really doing behind the scenes? Do you have a clue?
Well, you're asking me?
Yes.
Ask Eric.
Yeah.
He's the guy that implemented
it. Of course Eric would
know. Does Eric know the answer?
I don't know. What I do is I compile that.
Yeah.
I run .NET Reflector,
yes,
or look at the IL, and then I see what happens. No, that's joking.
It's a monad.
It's a monad. Well, it's, yes.
It's an implementation,
it's
of a query, kind of a query,
yes,
monad.
Let's not call it monad, because this is C#.
That'll,
yes.
That'll,
this is like, it's an implementation of the standard sequence operators.
Yes.
Okay.
With warm fuzzy things.
Yes, with warm fuzzy things. Yes.
Cool. But I mean, in the end, that's a good thing.
Yes.
That's great abstraction.
Yes.
So let's tell us. I mean, let's talk about what are those. What does that really mean?
Okay. Well, what we're really doing is kind of a Cartesian going through this. So what we're really doing, if we were to write this in our standard for each of our x in our first range, so range 1. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
All
right.
Then we go for each.
Nested for eaches.
Yep. For var y in range
2.
Okay, and then you're going to do a nice little yield return.
But now you still haven't explained what it is, because now what does this mean? This is like a.
Yes.
Let's just keep on going down the rabbit hole.
Exactly, because this is, in some sense, this is even more complicated, right?
Yes.
Because now you've used syntactic sugar for each.
Yes, that's
which
true.
Which is quite complicated syntactic sugar that goes down to get the numerator, while, move next, whatever. And then this guy is even. Blows it up in a state machine.
Sure.
So, so the thing is that is what you say, the rabbit hole programming is all about, like, layers and layers of abstraction.
Yeah. Right.
And then maybe in the end some, electrons are pushed around. And then they come back and they get kind of, wrapped up in all these abstractions, and you see something on your screen. Or
you find yourself sitting on a huge mushroom.
Oh, yes. Or maybe there's some money coming out of an ATM or something.
Certainly.
Yes,
all right.
But the semantics are kind of the same.
Yep.
But
with additional
let's write this using select many's and so on.
Okay.
You want to try?
Oh, you can go ahead. I've done my share of writing here.
Okay, so
I'm giving you the challenge this time.
Nice.
Okay, so this becomes
Eric on the hot seat. It's not quite fair though, he implemented this.
But that doesn't mean, it's like when you...
He has better handwriting than I do, though.
I must say, Eric, your handwriting is incredible,
not,
man.
No, it's not.
Have you been practicing?
So I wrote my master's thesis handwritten. So,
are you kidding?
Yes, so Dijkstra is like, a famous Dutch computer scientist who did every writing in handwriting, beautiful handwriting. I, just like Beckman, love fountain pens.
Okay.
And nothing writes better than a fountain pen. And also the speed of handwriting matches the slow speed of my thoughts. So I like to handwrite. Let me show people some secrets. Can you pass me my bag? So I'm talking about writing.
It's important. This is a good.
This is important. So this is my big book.
Yeah.
So I write all my stuff here. It's all, here, look at this. Move next, So algorithm with my fountain pen. So I either use a fountain pen or a pencil. It also kind of, you know, is nice. So here, this is all, you know, I write stuff here. So if
that's
you kind
amazing.
Of, you know, if you get this book, you have all my secrets.
Interesting. It's like a football coach's playbook.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hmm. Whereas with me, I've been programming since I was 6 years old. So I got accustomed to the keyboard quite early in my career.
6 years old. What did you start programming in?
Commodore 64 and VIC 20. I did Commodore Assembler and Commodore Basic. So, and then moved up in the world, of course, to PCs. After that, still doing C and Fortran and all those other.
What got you into programming? This is something that we kind of always kind of gloss over, but you are a human being after all. How on earth did a six-year-old start programming?
Well, it kind of helped though that my mother was also getting into those kinds of things at the same time. So,
nice.
She had raised us to a certain point, and now she was itching to get a career of her own. Uh-huh. And what did she do? She went into to the whole information systems world. So, I wasn't allowed to get anything like a Nintendo or. Anything like that. So I was given a book or a Computes Gazettes and said, here, write your games. And
that is a really interesting point. That is one way to get your children into programming. You want to play games, huh? Write your own.
Yes.
I think that's a great idea.
Yes.
You're my man. Salute to your mom. Right on.
Yeah, yeah. So I definitely owe a bit of gratitude to her, and as well as my dad, who has also remained quite technical in that world. So yeah, it's kind of pushed me in this general direction. So I'm always a language geek. I'm always trying to figure out new things and kind of push computers in interesting directions, even if it causes them to melt down. So
perfect, man. Right on.
Yeah. So talk about a Commodore 64 and so on. So that was probably Basic, right?
Yep, Commodore Basic.
Basic.
All right.
Yes. So and I must say I keep, you know, this is so amazing that, you know, if you look at the kind of, you know, the, like I did Apple II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
we had those at school. Yeah.
Yes, and the Basic manual was like 10 pages.
Yes.
I mean, that was everything, right?
Yep.
And
that was the world.
That was the world. And you know, do I have here? You know, it's like, do I have?
Yeah. You have one?
No, I don't have the Basic manual, but let's see. Do I have C++ book here? No. I don't have I have my books at home, most of my books at home.
You have a Cuisinart, though. That's impressive.
Yeah. The,
what is that?
Cuisinart. Oh, this is like a prize that I won for the best disaster story, which is actually about Haskell. The kind of that we should use Haskell. So then I won this.
Soft serve.
So this is my prize chest here. So all my prizes.
Nice.
But this book.
Yeah. Wow.
This is the best book ever written on programming languages.
Oh, Wadler. Yeah.
Burton Wadler.
Yeah.
Make sure that when you get the first edition. So this is the first edition.
Okay.
From 1988, I think. Here. Okay. Is this on camera?
It's on camera.
It's here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and now I'm spilling the beans here, because, you know, what I've been doing is I've been buying all the secondhand copies. So this thing, I don't know, this is from somebody here. I bought it like on.
So you want to make sure nobody else gets it, so you own the sort of the cloth.
Yes. So what I've been doing is I've been kind of, you know, buying all the secondhand copies of Burton Wadler and then giving it away to special people.
All right.
So,
can I have one?
Two here. Well, look at Charles.
Yeah. Wow.
Of course, Charles, you can have one.
Thank you, man.
But this is the, if you want to learn about functional programming, this book is kind of by far the best book in the world.
Absolutely. And what's interesting to me is somehow throughout time, functional technologies are actually older than object-oriented programming and so on, that you had a lot of the stuff in the late 50s of Lisp with McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And since then it's kind of had its ups and downs, of course. You know, it's ups in the 80s with the Lisp crowd, and then more resurgent than in the late 90s, and now with Haskell, and now you have OCaml's, you have the schemes, the F-sharps, the...
Yes, we have to kind of show that too, right?
Yeah.
F-sharp.
Of course,
you know.
Eric Meyer, of course.
Well, but that's kind of minor, right? This, of course, Don and his co-authors.
Yeah.
This is
stuff.
A real book. I have this kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's a great
next
reference.
My keyboard here because I need it.
Yeah.
And then this book, I should also plug that because that other book, the Bird and Water, is kind of, you know, about general functional programming.
Yes.
This book, Programming in Haskell, it's like really thin.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, look, it's
the
half
theory.
The pages are half empty.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's beautifully typeset. And this one is the most readable introduction to Haskell. We already talked about real-world Haskell, but if you want to learn kind of Haskell, you know, from, you know, Haskell 101, I think this is your choice.
I've got that also sitting on my bookshelf, absolutely.
Yes.
Now, the book that you gave me, this one,
here,
for people to see, the first two sentences in the preface says, this is about... I'm paraphrasing. This is about the concepts of functional programming.
Yes.
We don't expect that you even have any computer experience or any programming experience.
Yep.
The Haskell book's going to expect that you have some of this knowledge already in your head, right?
No.
So
that's the kind of interesting thing about that book. That book was written for Oxford students.
Yes.
And Oxford students have brains that don't
fit in
this room.
Okay.
But still, that's kind of so that.
Then why the hell did you give it to me, man?
Maybe
my mind will grow.
Yes, exactly. You know, you can still grow new brain cells, Charles. So just practice.
Okay.
You know, maybe you should get a Nintendo DS or something and do the kind of brain age. but anyway, so that book is really good, but it's very conceptual, as it says. So it's about functional programming concepts, and it doesn't use a particular syntax.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so it just talks about functional programming in general.
Yep.
And that's what we're going to start doing so that all the Niners know. We're going to start a series on Channel 9 about concepts.
Exactly, where I will basically kind of give you lectures from that book.
Totally. All the Niners are going to get understanding for free right here, you guys.
Yep. Okay. So this
so we
book
just give a little
and most modern books, and like the F-sharp book, are really about like a particular language and a particular syntax.
Yep.
In some sense, you know, maybe there's also a sign of the times, because when we were young, we were talking about you know, Commodore BASIC.
Yep.
You know, we would be happy with writing, you know, 10, you know, and, you know, peak.
Yep.
You know,
and poke,
and you know, whatever.
If you knew the right memory address to get a nice, pretty color, yes.
Exactly. Right. So the programs were really simple.
Yep.
But these days, you know, they want to write 3D, you know, multi-user distributed games and so on.
Yeah.
So and that's why a lot of the new books are kind of, you know, very much applied. So it's not only the language, but it's kind of tied to a particular, you know, framework. Whereas that book, Bird and Water, is really purely conceptual.
Yep.
And maybe you get frustrated because, when can I start coding? No. It's about kind of, you know, how do you think in a functional
sense? Well, and this is something that we've talked about before, and I'll ask you this. I mean, you blog, I'm sure you have a lot of imperative people that will read your blog and will ask you questions. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if I'm an imperative developer, I think in an imperative way.
Absolutely.
Right? Just as Yuri mentions in research, one of our experts, his argument is we're sequential thinkers, right? We're not really asynchronous thinkers in terms of being able to focus on more than X number of things at the same time, right?
Okay.
So if I'm an imperative programmer and you start throwing this functional stuff at me, you gotta understand that I'm going to have to try to conceptualize it. And if I have no foundation upon which to understand new functional concepts, then I'm just writing syntax, man, and hoping that it works.
That's interesting. So let's talk about it.
Okay.
How do you think? Because if I, you know, we've been talking now about these computations and so on.
Yeah.
But so the way that I think, and so I'm curious about how you think.
Okay.
Just all the pens and all the ends up there. So when I think about programs, about computations, I think about something that, you know, very abstractly say, you know, something, there's some set of values A, you know, and there's some set of values B, and now my computation kind of, you know, takes values in here and produces values in there, and, you know, while doing that, you know, some effects might happen, you know, this light might go on or something.
Or a nuclear weapon
or
might be launched.
Or a nuclear weapon might be launched
fair
or
enough,
something.
Fair enough.
But I really think in that kind of abstraction, I don't think in terms of steps or something. I kind of see in my head, I see, you know, kind of values kind of, you know, flowing through the air and kind of, you know, being transferred and combined.
Yeah.
So I don't know about you.
It is interesting because a lot of the times when we've grown people grow up with imperative programming, they suddenly say, oh, okay, now we're thinking about logic trees. Now I'm like, oh, now I have to do a for loop throughout all of these items, and now I might have to do a while here. You're thinking more about syntax than actual data flow, a lot of the times. So that's what I found a lot of the times is people are so bent on, oh, well, these for each read so nicely because that's what I'm so used to in terms of how data flows. So when you think about that, you're like, okay, well, instead, why don't you just think about exactly something like this? Well, I'm transforming A to B, and something in the middle happens.
Which is a side effect.
That's a side effect. So if you look at this guy, the way we would write this, this would be like A to M of B, where this M kind of, you know, corresponds to that guy, right?
Yes, a light bulb
or, you know, state gets changed or something like that.
Maybe a light bulb, maybe a rabbit.
Maybe a rabbit. And now the funny thing is that now if I want to kind of, you know, transform this to C, right, where there's another kind of, you know, light bulb kind of, you know, happening here, now what you have to do is you have to kind of, you know, hook these light bulbs up such that when something goes wrong here, that light bulb goes on here. And that's exactly what we saw when Matthew implemented the maybe monad, right? Where, you know, if this guy returns none, the whole computation, because now I've composed these two, the whole computation returns none. So, you know, if I look at the light bulbs for this whole computation, now that should go on, no value. So, and that's really all, you know, the way I think about computation. Sure. It's just composition. You're kind of like Lego blocks. You kind you click things together. You click these computations together. And then the side effects, you know, you wire them up kind of on a separate plane.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Yeah, and that's I've had the opportunity to give several talks, and what they're saying, a lot of people what they're doing is that, you know, creating these large mega methods with no real possibility of reuse because they're looping and doing what have you. Instead, I've said, well, why don't you break down the problem into the smallest possible pieces, and then you can start building these things together with little blocks, so you can say this result then goes to this result, then goes to this result, and so on, where the value is flowing all the way through. So if we're talking about the maybe, then it goes none, okay, now I'm short-circuiting back to here.
Mm-hmm. And what you're talking, I mean, you're talking about composability.
Yes.
So we're coming all the way back to a couple years ago.
Yes.
We started talking about software composability. Composition.
And, compositionality. And that is the thing, is like my brains, I always joke, but I think it's really true, are the size of a peanut. Okay, so the only way I can understand things is by breaking up a big problem in smaller pieces. Like, you know, I have to go from A to C. How do I do that? Well, first go from A to B and then from B to C. So I've broken this big problem up into small steps.
Yep.
And then there's two aspects to that. There's the kind of real computation, that's the actual transformation, and then there's all the effects. So this is the boilerplate code, or I don't know how you called it. You had a nice thing, structural complexity.
Uniform complexity.
Yes, that's the kind of crap that you don't want to deal with, right? And you hook that up, and this, you can hook this stuff up once and for all. And that's what the monad does, whenever, or in F-sharp, when you define your XXX builder, that's what you're doing. You're telling, how do I wire up this stuff? You know, that's always the same. And then you can concentrate on what actually is important, the transformations, the pure transformations. Mm. And that, I think, is to me the kind of big advantage of functional programming, where I can separate the essence, namely, you know, going from A to B, from B to C, and then the stuff that is always the same, namely how effects are handled, or maybe how things are wired through, etc.
Yeah, so it could be a for loop, it could be an if statement, it could be any number of things. Try catches for all you care, okay? And then it returns you either at the end, it returns you the real value, or it returns you the exception that's somewhere along the way happened. and those kinds of things. So you can still compose. And when something happens, well, you can do something about it, but you didn't have to worry about all that boilerplate when you're thinking about composability.
Excellent.
Yes. And so to go back to it, like Beckman is like, you know, Brian and I are always kind of...
I know, man.
So the thing is, if we look at this kind of state monad, you mentioned that. So what happens with the state monad? That state kind of flows here, you know, flows here, and then flows out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But the way... And now, really, what you have here is like, you know, your computation takes an A and a state and returns a B and a new state.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? So the real thing that you have, it's something of type A arrow... State arrow B comma state.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what you see here. There's your state. Let's put it in green. So your state comes in, your A comes in. Now I get an A and an S, and I produce a B and a new state. And then I compose that with this next function here. Mm-hmm. And that's what the state monad does. It kind of, you know, composes these functions, which if we write it simply, it's like A to state of B. And
right.
Again, we have hidden now all that boilerplate code in that construct.
Excellent.
And that's all.
Yep.
So there's nothing difficult. I mean, if I can understand it, it's trivial. So, I mean, that's...
I wouldn't go that far, but I think this is great. I mean, this is the way we really need to start explaining this to our customers and developers out there. I mean, this is important concepts first. Even I can grasp the stuff. But if you look at a state monad... implemented in syntax.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's C# or Haskell. It's not that easy to understand. Unless you are fluent in the syntax.
Yes.
But the concepts are much more easier to understand.
Yes. And the concept is like, you know, often, you know, you can explain these concepts. They are not that difficult.
Yeah.
It's that the languages like C#, now with Link, it has kind of special syntax. F# has workflows. Haskell has monads. So they have special support now to write these things, but without that syntactic support, that boilerplate code here shines through.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then you don't get the clarity that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Excellent.
When all you really want to do is have a put and a get statement. Say, I'm going to put this into state, or I'm going to get this out of state. And that's all you want to do.
Yep.
And then you want to say run state.
Excellent.
And in some sense, that's also an interesting observation. If you look at pure imperative language like C#, or, you know, I don't know, Java or C++, what really is going on, they also have this notion of monad, but there it's kind of hardwired into the language. So, because in C# or C++ or whatever, there is state, namely that's your heap and your stack, which is kind of implicitly threaded through. You don't have to write that. So whenever in C++ or Java or C# you write a normal method, it really has this type. It takes an A and it returns a B, but it affects
the world.
Right? Yeah. And then you say, now I don't
have to...
The shared state. And then you say, okay, now I'm silent about that because that's the default.
Mm. Yeah.
So that works really well until you want to have something else than this. So they don't make it compositional or programmable.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what these async workflow, or workflow expressions or computation expressions.
Yeah, exactly.
So monad comprehensions.
Yeah, monad comprehensions,
yes.
So why don't we just call it what it is?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. And what that gives you is a way to parameterize over that ambient thing. So it puts kind of power into the hands of programmers. So you can define your own kind of, you know, semantic domain here.
Excellent.
Yep.
And that's where the power needs to be, man.
Yeah.
Power in the hands of the programmers.
Exactly.
It's like with knives and fire, right?
Yeah.
It's also dangerous.
Yeah.
But I mean, you give them sort of, you know, blunt objects that are super powerful, right? If you the most important object for people to have, for programmers to have, is knowledge, man.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, syntax is just, come on, it's like exercising.
Yeah,
it's
exactly. So, Eric actually did mention the async workflow, which is actually a pretty powerful concept in trying to kind of abstract away the uniform complexity of dealing with asynchronous operations.
Mm.
And that's always been a problem. I mean, when you look at it, you say, okay, well, now I'm going to start reading from a reading from a file stream. So, and I want to do it asynchronously. So you call that begin read, and then it takes and a callback and some state, and then you have to then nest it once again inside of there for the callbacks, and then do your next call, compose it again, and you're just creating these callbacks left and right, just going, walking through there of nothing but closures this time around, of going all the way across the board just to try to do some asynchronous operations.
Yeah. And so we can also explain that thing in terms of pictures, right? Sure. Because if you're doing and
that's a good thing.
Yes,
right?
I think that's a good thing. So here's how a normal synchronous computation works, right? You get a value of here. I get that value, and now it's synchronous, so I get that value and I move it here, and now I can compute B from that. Mm-hmm. I get a new value and I move it here and I compute a C from that, and then I'm done.
Yeah.
With asynchronous computations, when I want an A, I have to wait. So what you do is you go to B and you say, here's a callback that when you're done, give me that A. Okay? So now, the same way here, If I'm in C, I don't have the B yet, so I have a callback to B that tells me when you're done, call me back. Yep. But this guy had a callback to A, right? Yep. So now we have this.
Changing.
So you see that your program flow that was first very natural like this is now completely
dotted.
Like, you know, now your brain is kind of, it's like you pull into your throat, you pull out your brain, and like that's how it feels. And so the control flow is now completely reversed, because there's a callback here that tells B, when you're done, tell me, and B has a callback here, tell me when you're done. So this guy now has a callback to here. Okay? Mm-hmm. And with these workflows, or with monads or whatever, you can turn this around.
Yep.
And now you can just write it as if that was with the let bang and so on. You can write it as if
already a normal transactional script, absolutely.
And now, it allows you to kind of have this completely different control flow, but you write the program as if the control flow was like this.
Yep.
And that's the
great.
Kind of very powerful thing of these.
Absolutely. And what it really abstracts is it abstracts away all those callbacks. Plus, it gives you the ability to have exception propagation, because that's also a pretty nasty thing in asynchronous computations.
And not even only in asynchronous.
Yes.
In some sense, we can say this maybe thing was like about propagating exceptions, right?
Yep.
The none is like an exception.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
so in the async world, that's, and now that we have the picture, there's like, as Matthew says, there's like a second thing here where, you know, I said, well, B says, hey, A, once you're done, call me back. But maybe it says, hey, once it fails, you have to call me back with a different callback, right?
Yeah.
The one, this red one, that is like when you error. So now it's like, now you have kind of pulled out your brains and kind of, you know, I don't know.
Combinatorial insanity.
Yes. Yeah. You're going completely insane.
Yeah. And what's worse is, what if you get what if you get five or six operations in there and say, whoa, I hit a point in here, I need to cancel these.
Ooh, now I get like yet. I already had green. Well, now I yet have three. So now I have three callbacks. Okay. And now it really gets insane.
Absolutely.
It really gets insane.
And that's a good way to leave it for this episode.
Perfect.
Perfect.
We leave everybody insane.
We leave everybody insane. Awesome to talk to you again,
Thank
Eric.
You.
Thank you.
And Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice job. Great to meet you.
Thank you.